come up short again in the last few hundred feet of the 4-mile varsity race. Whatever else happened, they were determined that they would not lose the race in that way this year. So they came up with a race plan. Ulbrichtsen had always liked to come from behind to save something for the end of the race. But in the past, he'd always tried to get a strong start, stay close to the leaders throughout, and then defeat them with a killing sprint at the end. The new plan stuck close to that basic strategy, but with a twist. They would leave the starting line with just enough of a surge to get some momentum behind the boat, but then drop immediately to a low stroke rate of 28 or 29. What's more, they'd keep it low no matter what the other boats were doing, so long as they stayed within roughly 2 lengths of the field. Ideally, they would stay low for a full mile and a half, then take it up to 31 until they got to the 2-mile mark. At 2 miles, Bobby Mock would tell Don Hume to gun it and start taking down the leaders, who would by now be starting to tire. The deliberately slow start was risky. It meant they'd likely have to pass every boat on the river on their way to the finish line. But at the very least, they'd still be rowing hard at the end. When they were all in agreement, Al Ulbrichtsen went to tell Bobby Mock the plan. The Washington boys arrived in Poughkeepsie early in the morning on June 14th in the midst of a summer thunderstorm. Drenched to the skin by torrential rain, they unloaded the shells from a baggage car, lifted them over their heads, and hustled down to the river to stow the boats and inspect their new quarters. They were not using the rickety old shack on the Highlands side of the river this year. Al Ulbrichtsen had arranged for them to move into Cornell's former house, a much more substantial structure on the east side of the river, right next door to the California house. As they shed their wet coats and tromped through the building, they marveled at the luxuries the new quarters afforded. There were hot showers, exercise facilities, electric lights, and a spacious dormitory, complete with extra-long beds. There was even a radio, on which the boys would be able to listen to everything from baseball games to Fibber McGee and Molly, to live broadcasts of the New York Philharmonic direct from Carnegie Hall, or, if Joe got his hands on the dial, to the National Barn Dance from Chicago. There was a wide screened-in porch where they could sleep if the weather turned hot, and, as the rain thundered down outside, it was no small thing that the roof didn't leak. By the time they had finished settling in, they could smell food cooking. Led by their noses, and by Joe Rance's nose in particular, they quickly discovered the best feature of the new place, a cookhouse on the beach, just 25 feet from their front door. In command of the cookhouse was the imposing figure of Evander May Calamar, a lady of color, and, as it would turn out, an awe-inspiring cook. Working for her were her son Oliver, her mother, and her brother-in-law, all busily preparing fried chicken for the Washington boys' lunch. The boys quickly found that they had just landed smack dab in the heart of hog heaven. Royal Brougham, amused, watched them go at their first meal and then wired home a story about it. The Post-Intelligencer ran it under a picture of Joe, captioned, "Joe Rance, the Eating Champion." Over the next few days, George Pocock went from boathouse to boathouse tending to the shells of Washington's competitors. 17 of the 18 boats on the river this year had again come out of his shop. Pocock enjoyed working on them, adjusting the riggers, revarnishing hulls, making minor repairs. He didn't want to see shabby or derelict boats with his name on them out on the river, and this kind of service made for excellent customer relations. The first place he went was right next door to the California Boathouse to tend to Kai Ebright's boats. The Washington boys, though, declined to speak to the California boys, and vice versa. On the float they shared, the two crews passed each other silently, with eyes averted, only taking the occasional sidelong glance like dogs circling before a fight. And a fight was a real possibility. Not long after they arrived, a reporter sauntered up to Shorty Hunt and mentioned that the impression in the California shell house was that the Washington boys seemed to think they were awfully tough, that they seemed always to be spoiling for a fight, that if they couldn't pick a fight with someone else, they'd pick a fight with themselves, but that California would be happy to save them the trouble. Shorty replied, "If those lobs want to fight, we'll fight, but we aren't looking for any." Meanwhile, Ulbrichtsen and Bowles began to work their boys hard, rowing at a low rate, but for long distances, trying to take right back off the 3 or 4 pounds they had deliberately encouraged them to put on during the train trip. The theory was that they would thus arrive at a perfect racing weight and in perfect condition by race day on June 22nd, neither too light nor too heavy. Mrs. Calamar's cooking, however, was soon countering the coach's best efforts. Then news leaked out that the California Varsity had turned in a blazing 19 minutes 31 seconds over 4 miles. It was by far the year's fastest time on the river. The Cornell boys had also begun to turn in impressive times. On the evening of June 17th, Al Ulbrichsen kicked things up a notch and staged a time trial of his own. Rowing at 9 in the evening, under the cover of darkness and in rough water, Joe and his crewmates streaked down the 4 mile course in what Al Ulbrichsen told riders was a time just a fraction of a second over 19 minutes 39 seconds, significantly off Cal's impressive 19 minutes 31 seconds. Johnny White recorded the true time in his journal that night, 19 minutes 25 seconds. The next day, rumors began to circulate that California had held yet another time trial. Ebright wouldn't reveal the time, but observers reported that his varsity had come in with a phenomenal time of 18 minutes 46 seconds. The Poughkeepsie Eagle News had it at 18 minutes 37 seconds. Royal Brougham wired a grim report back to the Post-Intelligencer. The sun-browned oarsmen of California will again rule as the favorites. That's not rowing. It's flying. But Ulbrichsen remained unruffled. He wanted well-rested boys in the race, and he'd seen enough. He told his boys to relax. From now until race day on the 22nd, there would be only light workouts to keep in shape. That was fine with the boys. They already knew something that nobody else knew, not even Ulbrichsen. Late on the night of the final time trial, after the wind had died down and the waters had calmed, they had begun to row back up the river in the dark, side by side with the freshmen and JV boats. Soon the red and green running lights of the coach's launch disappeared upriver. The shells passed under the two bridges draped with shimmering necklaces of amber lights. Along the shore and up on the palisades, warm yellow light poured from the windows of homes and shell houses. It was a moonless night. The water was ink black. Bobby Mock set the varsity boys to rowing at a leisurely 22 or 23. Joe and his crewmates chatted softly with the boys in the other two boats, but they soon found that they had pulled out ahead without meaning to, just pulling soft and steady. Soon, in fact, they had pulled so far ahead that they could not even hear the boys in the other boats. And then, one by one, they realized that they couldn't hear anything at all, except for the gentle murmur of their blades dipping into and out of the water. They were rowing in utter darkness now. They were alone together in a realm of silence and darkness. Years later, as old men, they all remembered the moment Bobby Mock recalled. You couldn't hear anything except for the oars going in the water. It'd be a zep, and that's all you could hear. The oarlocks didn't even rattle on the release. They were rowing perfectly, fluidly, mindlessly. They were rowing as if on another plane, as if in a black void among the stars, just as Pocock had said they might. And it was beautiful. In the final days before the Poughkeepsie Regatta, another big sports story dominated the headlines on sports pages and sometimes on front pages around the country, the story of a heavyweight boxing match. Max Schmeling of Germany had been the heavyweight champion of the world from 1930 to 1932, and he was set on reclaiming the title from James Braddock. But a 22-year-old African-American boxer from Detroit named Joe Louis stood in Schmeling's way. Louis had battled his way through 27 professional matches with 23 knockouts and no defeats to reach his current status as the number one challenger in the world. In doing so, he had gradually begun to erode the racial attitudes of many, though far from all, white Americans. He was on his way, in fact, to becoming one of the first African Americans to be widely viewed as a hero by ordinary white Americans. Louis's rise to prominence had been so spectacular that few American sports writers or bookies gave Schmeling much of a chance. In Germany, though, the view was very different. Although Schmeling was not a Nazi Party member, Joseph Goebbels and the Nazi elite had enthusiastically latched onto him and promoted him as a symbol of German and Aryan supremacy. The German press, under the careful direction of the Minister of Propaganda, had made much of the upcoming fight. Everyone on both sides of the Atlantic had an opinion about what would happen. Even the crew coaches in Poughkeepsie took time out to comment on the fight. Schmeling might go four rounds, opined Al Ulbrichsen. Kai Ebright was blunter. Lewis will murder him. When the fight began in a sold-out Yankee stadium on the evening of June 19th, Lewis was, at 8-1, the overwhelming favorite in New York. In Germany, though interest in the fight was at a fever pitch, there was almost no betting on the fight. The odds were so low on Schmeling that few wanted to risk their cash, and no one wanted to be caught betting on a black American. In a small square of white light in the vast, dark void of the stadium, Lewis stalked Schmeling around the ring like a predator for three rounds, lacing him with hard left jabs to the face. It looked as if it would be a short evening. But in the fourth round, out of nowhere, Schmeling landed a hard right to the temple that knocked Lewis to a sitting position on the floor. Lewis took a count of two and then rose to his feet, covering his face and retreating until the bell sounded. Through the fifth round, Lewis seemed dazed and ineffective. And then, at the end of the fifth, following the bell, which neither fighter heard over the crowd noise, Schmeling landed a particularly devastating right hand to the left side of Lewis's head. For the next six rounds, Lewis staggered about the ring, punished by a relentless barrage of rights to the jaw, somehow staying on his feet, but scoring few, if any, points, and inflicting little damage on the German boxer. Many in the overwhelmingly white crowd had by now turned suddenly and savagely against Lewis. Delirious with joy, by the New York Times account, they screamed for Schmeling to end it. Finally, in the 12th, Schmeling went in for the kill. With Lewis now careening almost aimlessly around the ring, the German leaned into Lewis's body and launched a rapid-fire flurry of hard rights to his head and face, followed by one final crushing blow to the jaw. Lewis sank to his knees, then toppled forward on his face. Referee Arthur Donovan counted him out. In the dressing room afterward, Lewis said he couldn't remember anything about the fight beyond the fifth round. That night in Harlem, grown men wept openly in the streets. Younger men threw rocks at cars full of white fans returning from the match. In German-American sections of New York, people danced in the streets. In Berlin, Adolf Hitler wired his congratulations to Schmeling and sent his wife flowers. But no one in Germany was happier with the evening's development than Joseph Goebbels. He had spent the night at his posh summer house at Schwanenwerder, sitting with Magda and Schmeling's wife Annie, listening to the fight on the radio into the wee hours. He sent Schmeling a congratulatory telegram of his own. "We are proud of you, with best wishes and Heil Hitler." Then he ordered the state-controlled Reuters news agency to issue a statement. "Inexorably, and not without justification, we demand Braddock shall defend the title on German soil." The next day, still excited, Goebbels sat down and made an entry in his journal. "We were on tenterhooks the whole evening with Schmeling's wife. We told each other stories, laughed, and cheered. In round 12, Schmeling knocked out the Negro. Fantastic. A dramatic, thrilling fight. Schmeling fought for Germany and won. The white man prevailed over the black, and the white man was German. I didn't go to bed until 5. In the end, though, Joe Lewis would have the last laugh. He would indeed fight Max Schmeling again, 2 years later, and Schmeling would last all of 2 minutes and 4 seconds before his corner threw in the towel. Joe Lewis would reign as heavyweight champion of the world from 1937 to 1949, long after Joseph Goebbels' charred body had been pulled out of the smoldering rubble of the Reich Chancellery in Berlin and laid next to those of Magda and their children. On Saturday evening, Ulbrichsen told the varsity they could take the coaching launch out for a spin if they wanted. They were bored with the amusement park just up the hill, and Ulbrichsen didn't want them lounging around the house all evening getting restless and nervous about the race on Monday. The boys recruited one of the crew's student managers as pilot and navigator, and piled into the boat. Not sure where to go, they decided they'd pay a visit to the President of the United States, whom they understood to live somewhere upriver. They goosed the throttle, and the boat swung out into the river, heading north past the Navy and Columbia shell houses. They roared northwest through the bend at Crum Elbow and continued another 2 miles alongside forest and cliff until they came to a dock marked Hyde Park Station. There they asked someone how to get to the President's house and were directed to a cove 1 mile back down the river. When they found the cove, they left the manager in charge of the boat, crossed some railroad tracks, walked gingerly across a narrow trestle, and headed uphill through the woods. For the next half hour, they wandered up bridle paths and overgrown roads, hurrying across broad lawns and trooping past an abandoned grist mill and a stable the size of a cathedral, until they finally came across some greenhouses and a gardener's cottage that appeared to be occupied. They knocked on the door, and an elderly couple appeared. When the boys asked whether they were anywhere near the president's estate, the couple nodded enthusiastically and announced that they were standing on it, then pointed out the way to the main house. Walking through the adjoining nursery and up another path, they finally arrived on a wide gravel drive leading up to a large expanse of lawn, on which stood Springwood, the Roosevelt stately three-story brick and masonry mansion, complete with a semicircular portico supported by white Grecian columns. It was by far the most magnificent house any of them had ever seen. Nervous, but too far along to back down now, they shuffled deferentially up onto the portico and peered inside. It was coming on to 9 o'clock and growing dark. Inside, they could see a young man about their age leaning against the end of a long table and reading a book. They knocked on the door. The young man appeared to call for a servant, but then put the book down and came to the door himself. When he opened the door, the boys announced who they were, mentioned that they had met John Roosevelt the previous year, and asked if the president was in. He was not, the young man said, but he invited them in eagerly. He was, he said, Franklin Roosevelt, Jr., but they should call him Frank. He grinned slightly and announced that he rode in the number 6 seat in the Harvard JV boat and had just returned from New London, Connecticut, where, though the Crimson's varsity had won their annual race against Yale, the JV had not. Just before the race, he said, Harvard's coach, Charlie Whiteside, had been fired, and there was a great deal of talk now that the next head coach at Harvard would be a fellow named Tom Bowles, particularly if Bowles pulled off another freshman victory at Poughkeepsie. Roosevelt couldn't wait to talk to the boys from Washington. He ushered them into the president's library and sat them down, and began talking rapidly about rowing and about coaches. As he talked, the boys gaped at the room. Most of the walls were lined from the floor to the high ceiling with shelves of books. Any spots on the walls not taken up by books were covered with pictures of American presidents and various Roosevelts. An ornate fireplace dominated the end of the room where they were seated. In front of the fireplace was a 15-foot-long library table stacked with new editions of books on every conceivable topic. Nearly every other table in the room had a vase of fresh flowers or a porcelain figurine on it. Shorty Hunt, starting to relax, settled into a comfortable upholstered chair near the fireplace, and then nearly jumped out of it when Frank told him it was the president's favorite, and that he occasionally delivered his famous fireside chats on the radio from that very chair. They talked for an hour. Later that night, back at the shell house, Johnny White got out his diary and wrote as if he had just stopped in at a neighbor's house back in Seattle. Visited the president's home at Hyde Park tonight. They sure have a fine place. By the morning of the regatta, the consensus in the Eastern press, at least, was that California and Cornell were the boats to beat in the varsity race, with Washington expected to come in, perhaps, just a beat or two behind the leaders. Cornell, after all, had come within 0.4 of a second of beating California the year before. The Seattle papers gave the odds narrowly to Washington. Royal Brougham, despite his earlier gloomy assessment, had already announced his personal prognostication. Washington to win, Cornell in second, California third. Writing for the Post-Intelligencer that morning, though, he said he thought Cal would probably go off as the slight favorite among the bookmakers. Actually, the bookies in the cigar shops in Poughkeepsie had Cal and Washington at even money, with Cornell lagging just behind at 8-5. The bottom line seemed to be that any one of the three schools might win the varsity honors. Now Brougham was poking around town. He wanted to gather as much color as he could before it was time to sit down and pound out his story after the final race. Because of tidal conditions, the race would not go off until after 8 p.m., just after sundown. So Brougham took his time, looking for tidbits. It was, he noted, a fine, clear day in Poughkeepsie. A few cottony white clouds drifted across a pale blue sky, moved along by just enough of a breeze to keep things pleasantly cool. At mid-afternoon, he hiked down the steep descent to the waterfront, where a U.S. Navy destroyer and 2 Coast Guard cutters had taken up positions among the usual flotilla of yachts, sailboats, launches, dinghies, and canoes assembling near the finish line. At the California Shell House, Kai Ebright sat on the upstairs porch, wearing dark glasses, nodding and smiling at people as they streamed by below, saying nothing. Next door, Al Ulbrichsen, wearing an unusually colorful outfit, a white cloth cap, a yellow striped sweater, and the lucky purple tie given to him by Loyal Shoudy back in 1926, sat on the dock in front of the Washington Shell House. When pressed for a comment by a gaggle of reporters, Ulbrichsen spat into the water, chewed a piece of grass, and looked at the wind-ruffled river for a long while before finally saying, "Going to be fast if she flattens out a little." Royal Brougham moved on. He knew that was about all the press boys were going to get out of Ulbrichsen. By late afternoon, the Main Street wharf was crowded with people waiting for ferries to get them across the river to the observation train. Brougham sat watching as dozens of lesser boats, everything from outboard speedboats to rowboats, also ferried more people of all sorts across, tipsy women in fashionable Fifth Avenue hats, fat men with cigar stubs in their mouths, old men wearing raccoon coats and clutching college pennants. One by one, the freshman crews boarded their shells and began to paddle upriver to the starting line near the Columbia Shell House, an elegant structure that looked as if it could double as the clubhouse of any of the East's fine country clubs. A little before 6 p.m., Royal Brougham climbed aboard the observation train on the west side of the river, just as it was about to start backing up toward the 2-mile freshman starting line, pulling a press car and 23 flat cars with bleachers full of fans sitting under white canvas canopies. As many as 90,000 people now lined both sides of the Hudson, the largest crowd in years. The earlier breeze had died down, and the water was placid, smooth and glassy, tinged with bronze in the slanting late afternoon light. Ulbrichsen was right. It was going to be fast. As the train began to back up, Tom Bowles, wearing his battered lucky fedora, had much to ponder. He had heard what had happened to Charlie Whiteside. Harvard had made clear to the world that they were prepared to pay handsomely to get what they wanted in the way of a new head coach, and Bowles knew he was again at the top of their list. If his boys came through for him yet again this year, he'd be getting an offer. And he figured, this time, he'd probably take it. His boys did come through for him, and they made short, sweet work of it. When the race went off, exactly at 6 p.m., Navy and California moved out to early leads. Washington settled in at a relatively low beat of 32, but stayed close. Pulling gracefully and efficiently, they gradually overpowered Navy and settled in behind Cal. At the 1-mile mark, going under the railroad bridge, they crept ahead of Cal. California challenged several times, but Washington repeatedly moved back in front, still holding at 32. Finally, a quarter of a mile from the finish, California began its sprint, charging up from behind, one more time, to nose out ahead of Bowles' boys. Washington's coxswain, Fred Colbert, turned his crew loose. Washington exploded forward, rowing at 39 and pulling away from Cal by a full length at the line. And with that, Washington won the race, but lost Tom Bowles. An hour later, the JV race began, and once again Washington made short work of their opponents, rowing a remarkably similar race. Early on, Navy and Cornell pulled out ahead of Washington by a quarter of a length, but finding that he could hold his bow in that position with his crew rowing at a relaxed 30 or 31, Washington's cox, Winslow Brooks, was content to sit back and watch the two leaders burn themselves out. He sat there, in fact, for a mile and a half, then found that he was slowly pulling even with the boys from Annapolis and Berkeley without having asked his men to raise the beat. A mile above the finish line, he finally called on them to take up the stroke rate. The beat went to 37, and Washington simply got up and walked away from the field. The boys in the Navy and Cornell boats suddenly looked as if they were rowing in glue. Every stroke Washington took in the last mile widened the distance. They crossed the line 3 lengths ahead of Navy, still pulling away at the head of a long, strung-out parade of boats far to their rear. Even as the last boats crossed the line and the cheering began to die down, an audible murmur began to ripple through the crowd along the shore as a number of realizations clicked into place. Washington, for the second time in 2 years, now stood again on the brink of sweeping the regatta. California, on the other hand, could become only the second school ever to win the varsity race 4 years in a row, as well as the first to ever go on to win 3 consecutive Olympic berths, But there was still hope for Eastern fans. Cornell looked as if they could finally redeem their cause this year. Or maybe Navy. As the observation train drew back upriver again for the start of the varsity race, the atmosphere grew electric, the dusky sky crackling with static. The crowd began to buzz. Boat whistles shrilled. Alumni draped arms over one another's shoulders and sang fight songs. Somebody was about to win big. Somebody was about to lose big. 4 miles up the river, just below Crum Elbow, Joe Rance, sitting in the Husky Clipper near the eastern shore, heard 5 bombs go off downstream and knew that the Washington JV in the number 5 lane had won their race. He lifted his fist silently in the air. So did Shorty Hunt and Roger Morris. Half the boys in the JV boat had been members of their all-sophomore crew in 1935. Every one of them had been disappointed not to be sitting where Joe and Shorty and Roger were sitting, waiting for the varsity race to begin at 8 p.m. The sun had already slipped behind the Palisades on the west side of the river. The tips of church spires up in Poughkeepsie on the east side were just catching the last rays of sunlight. Down on the river, twilight was settling over the water like gray gauze. The river itself had turned a rich and lustrous shade of violet, reflecting the sky overhead. A line of gray stake boats stretched across the river, marking the starting line. Far downstream, twinkling lights began to appear at the portholes of some of the larger yachts anchored near the finish line. On the east side of the river, a passenger train flashed by, trailing clouds of swirling smoke. On the west side, the observation train jolted to a stop adjacent to the line of stake boats. Just above the line, a telegraph operator sat perilously on the steep riverbank, his keypad in hand and a strand of copper wire running up the hill behind him to a pole where he had made a connection with the main line, ready to tell the world when the race began. Joe and his crewmates began to paddle out to the line of stake boats to take their position. In the stern, Bobby Mock began quietly talking them through the race plan one more time. Out in Seattle, Hazel Ulbrichsen locked the front door to her home so as not to be disturbed during the race. Joyce got permission from Mrs. Tellwright to switch on the large cabinet radio in her parlor. On the observation train, in a press car full of Washington coaches, alumni, and sports writers, George Pocock and Tom Bowles paced up and down the aisle. Al Ulbrichsen sat alone in silence, methodically chewing a piece of gum, looking out intently from under the brim of his white cloth cap toward the spot where Joe sat. Washington had drawn the worst lane, number 7, far out in the middle of the river, where any hint of wind or current would be strongest, and where, in the failing light, it would be hard even to see the boat. As in 1935, California had drawn lane number 1, the most protected lane, snug up against the railroad embankment, sitting right under Ulbrichsen's nose. 10 years ago, Ulbrichsen himself had stroked Washington's varsity to a national championship here. No Washington varsity crew had won one since. Ulbrichsen remembered his oath to his wife, and his failed promise to Seattle the year before. The Olympics loomed. Nearly everything Al Ulbrichsen wanted out of life was going to be determined in the next 20 minutes. At 8 p.m., the starter called out, "Are you ready?" 2 coxswains raised their hands. The starter waited a minute or two, then called out again, "Are you all ready?" This time, 3 coxswains raised their hands. Exasperated, the starter waited again while the different crews made a few final adjustments. He called out a third time, "Are you all ready?" This time all 7 hands went up. The starting gun popped, the boats lurched away from the line, and the telegrapher, clinging to the riverbank, tapped at his key to let the world know that the 38th annual varsity crew race at Poughkeepsie was finally underway. For 5 full strokes, all 7 boats stayed absolutely abreast of one another, their crews digging hard. Then Washington suddenly eased up. The entire field surged out in front of them. That was okay with Bobby Mock. That was just what he wanted. He settled his crew in, rowing at a steady 28, and began to watch the backs of his rival coxswains disappear down the river into the dusk. To steady the boys, Mock began to chant their newest rowing mantra in time with the stroke. "Save, save, save," reminding them that this was all about conserving power. Pennsylvania, Navy, and California quickly moved out in front of the pack, rowing high at first, then gradually dropping their stroke rates into the low 30s. After half a mile, Washington was seventh in a field of seven, almost five lengths behind the leaders. Syracuse, and surprisingly, mighty Cornell, the big red hope of the East, continued to hang back with Washington, perhaps playing their game. Bobby Mock began to fudge his shell over toward the Syracuse lane. He was thinking ahead. Far down the course, his assigned lane was going to carry the Husky Clipper under the railroad bridge right at the point where water swirled around behind an abutment and flowed back upriver. If they ran into the swirl, the boat would all but stop momentarily. The only way he was going to avoid it was by running right down the line between his lane and Syracuse's. The Clipper slid over to the line until the Orange's blades were all but clicking up against the Huskies. Furious, the Syracuse coxswain began bellowing, cussing at Mock. As Washington pulled even, Mock leaned over toward the Syracuse boat, smiled and said, rather softly but in his deep baritone voice, "Go to hell, Syracuse." As the Syracuse coxswain resumed cussing, his boy's timing began to falter, and his boat began to fall back. A mile into the race, to the astonishment of the crowd on the observation train, Columbia had crept up to third place, passing California, and settling in behind Navy and Penn. As the boys from New York City stroked past the boys from Berkeley, New Yorkers on the train began to cheer. But by the mile-and-a-half mark, California had answered the move and powered back past Columbia and Penn into second again. Navy, California, and Penn now formed a cluster far out in front, exchanging leads, cutting each other up. Washington remained four full lengths behind the leaders. Cornell seemed unable to get anything going and lingered back near Washington. Syracuse had fallen well to the rear. In the press car, a hush had gradually fallen over the Washington contingent of riders and coaches as they had taken in just how far behind the Husky Clipper was. People began to murmur. "Come on, Bobby, take it up, take it up." Al Ulbrichsen was silent, calm, sphinx-like, slowly working the gum in his mouth. At any moment now, he figured, Bobby Mock would make his move, just as they'd planned. He stared ever more intently across the river as the growing darkness began to envelop the shell. All one could really see of Washington were the white tips of their blades appearing and disappearing rhythmically in the water, still at a nice, steady, leisurely 28. At 2 miles, Penn had begun to fade, falling behind Columbia. Cal and Navy were duking it out for the lead. Cornell had fallen behind Washington, which had moved into fifth place. But Bobby Mock still hadn't altered the beat at all. He was still four lengths back. In the press car, Al Ulbrichsen began to grow uneasy. Mock had been told not to let the leaders get more than two lengths ahead. He was twice that far behind, and he was supposed to have started moving by now. This was most definitely not the race plan Mock had been given. Tom Bowles and George Pocock sat down looking morose. It was starting to look like a case of suicide. But out on the water, Bobby Mock told Don Hume, "Take your time. We can catch those boys any time we want." As they passed the 2.5 mile mark, it was essentially the same story. California and Navy were far out in front, with Columbia trailing them. Washington had eased past a weakening Penn crew, but remained a devastating four lengths back. Ulbrichsen still didn't flinch. He just continued to stare out the window at the flickering white blades on the water, chewing his gum. But he had begun to slump in his seat. He couldn't believe what was happening. What on earth was Mock doing? Why in God's name didn't he turn them loose? In the boat, Bobby Mock took a look at the four lengths between his bow and California's stern and hollered to his crew, "Okay, you lugs, we're one length behind." Downriver, the thousands of fans packing the shoreline in yachts and other vessels in Poughkeepsie could not yet see the oncoming shells, but they could hear the coxswains barking like so many seals out in the river's darkness. Slowly, the barking grew closer. Then the bows of three boats began to materialize out of the gloaming, just beyond the railroad bridge. A roar went up as the crowd began to discern the state of play. Navy was neck and neck with Cal, and the two of them seemed to be running away with it, though Columbia, astonishingly, appeared to be in third place. Cornell, also astonishingly, was nowhere to be seen. But at least the East had one boat in the race, after all. Maybe two. Almost nobody even noticed the Washington shell, apparently limping along in the middle of the river, so far back one could barely see it in the gathering darkness. As the Washington boat swept under the black skeleton of the railroad bridge at the 3-mile mark, it was still nearly 3 lengths back with a mile to go. The leaders had slowed just a bit, and that had narrowed the gap, but if Mock had raised the rate at all, it was imperceptible. The Washington boys were rowing as if in a kind of trance now, somehow detached from themselves, yet keenly aware of one another's every minute motion. There was little sound out in the middle of the river, except for Mock's chanting, the rattle of the oars in oarlocks, their own deep rhythmic breathing, and their pulses pounding in their ears. There was almost no pain. In the number 5 seat, Stubb McMillan realized with astonishment that he was still breathing through his nose after 3 full miles of rowing. On the train, Al Ulbrichsen had all but given up. "They're too far behind," he muttered. "They're overplaying their hand. We'll be lucky to finish third." Ulbrichsen's face was ashen. It seemed to have turned entirely to stone. He'd even stopped chewing his gum. In the lane nearest to him, California had powered back out in front, rowing beautifully. With a tiring field behind them and less than a mile to go, Cal was in a commanding position to win. Kai Ebright, it seemed, had somehow outwitted him again. But if anybody had outwitted Al Ulbrichsen, it was his own coxswain, the short kid with his own Phi Beta Kappa key. And now he would show his hand. Suddenly he leaned into Don Hume's face and bellowed, "Give me 10 hard ones for Ulbrichsen!" 8 long spruce oars bowed in the water 10 times. Then Mock bellowed again, "Give me 10 more for Pocock!" 10 enormous strokes. Then another lie. "Here's California. We're on them. 10 more big ones for Mom and Dad." Very slowly, the Husky Clipper slipped past Columbia and began to creep up on Navy in second. Someone on the train idly remarked, "Well, Washington is picking up." A minute later, someone else called out, much more urgently, "Look at Washington! Look at Washington! Here comes Washington!" On the train and on shore, all eyes shifted from the leaders to the 8 white blades barely visible out in the middle of the river. Another deep guttural roar began to rise from the crowd. It seemed impossible for Washington to close the gap. They were 1/2 mile from the finish now, still in 3rd place, still 2 lengths back, but they were moving, and the way they were moving compelled immediate and absolute attention. In the boat, Mock was incandescent. "Okay, now, now, now," he barked. Don Hume took the stroke up to 35, then to 36, then to 37. On the starboard side, Joe Rance fell in behind him, just as smooth as silk. The boat began to swing. The bow began to rise out of the water. Washington slid past the middies as if the Navy boat were pinned to the water. Cal's coxswain, Grover Clark, glanced across the river, and for the first time since he'd left it behind at the starting line, he saw the Washington boat sweeping up on his stern. Stunned, he bellowed at his crew to pick it up, and Cal's rate climbed quickly to 38. Mock hollered at Hume to take it up another notch, and Washington went to 40. The rhythm of the California boat seemed to waver, then grow erratic. California and Washington careened into the last 500 yards, storming down the corridor of open water between the spectators' boats. People in rowboats were standing up now, risking a dunking to see what was happening. Some of the large excursion steamers began to list toward the center of the river as people crowded their rails. The roar of the crowd began to engulf the oarsmen. Boat whistles shrieked. On the float in front of Washington's shell house, Evander May Calamar, the crew's cook, waved a frying pan over her head, whooping and urging the boys on. In Washington's press car, pandemonium broke out. George Varnell of the Seattle Times shoved his press credentials into his mouth and began to devour them. Tom Bowles commenced beating a stranger on the back with his lucky old fedora. Royal Brougham was shouting, "Come on, Washington, come on!" Only Al Ulbrichsen remained motionless and silent, still riveted to his seat, his eyes cold gray stones locked on the white blades out in the river. Joe Williams of the World Telegram stole a glance at him and thought, "This guy has ice water in his veins." With the finish line looming ahead of him in the gathering dark, Bobby Mock screamed something inarticulate. Johnny White in the number 3 seat suddenly had the sensation that they were flying now, not rowing. Stubb McMillan desperately wanted to peek, to glance over toward lane 1, where he knew California would be, but he didn't dare. In number 6, over the crowd noise, Shorty Hunt could hear someone on a radio yelling frantically. He tried to make out the words, but all he could tell was that something terribly exciting was happening. He had no idea how things stood, except that he still hadn't seen the California boat fall into his field of view. He kept his eyes locked on the back of Joe Rance's neck and pulled with his whole heart. Joe had boiled everything down to one action, one continuous movement, one thought. The crew's old mantra running on through his mind like a river, hearing it over and over, not in his own voice, but in George Pocock's crisp Oxford accent, M-I-B, M-I-B, M-I-B. Then, in the last 200 yards, thinking itself fell away, and pain suddenly came shrieking back into the boat, descending on all of them at once, searing their legs, their arms, their shoulders, clawing at their backs, tearing at their hearts and lungs as they desperately gulped at the air. And in those last 200 yards, in an extraordinary burst of speed, rowing at 40 strokes per minute, pounding the water into a froth, Washington passed California. With each stroke, the boys took their rivals down by the length of another seat. By the time the two boats crossed the line, in the last vestiges of twilight, a glimmer of open water showed between the stern of the Husky Clipper and the bow of the California Clipper. In the press car, the corners of Al Obrigson's mouth twitched reluctantly into something vaguely resembling a smile. He resumed chewing his gum, slowly and methodically. Standing next to him, George Pocock threw back his head and howled like a banshee. Tom Bowles continued to flog the back of the fellow in front of him with his old fedora. George Varnell removed the well-masticated remains of his press credentials from his mouth. In Seattle, Hazel Obrigson and her son Al pounded the glass top of their coffee table until it shattered into dozens of pieces. Up on the automobile bridge, Mike Bogo had the distinct pleasure of setting off 7 bombs in rapid succession. In the boat, the boys pumped their fists in the dark night air. For a long while, Obrigson just sat there, staring into the darkness as fans came rushing through the car, congratulating him and slapping him on the back. When he finally stood up, reporters crowded around him, and he said simply, "Well, they made it close, but they won." Then he elaborated, "I guess that little runt knew what he was doing." Washington had become the national champions and swept the Hudson. The varsity's astounding come-from-behind victory that day was historic in its scope and drama. In the press center at the Poughkeepsie Railroad Station, the nation's sports writers sat down to typewriters and began to pound out superlatives. Robert Kelly of the New York Times called it a high mark in the history of Poughkeepsie. Herbert Allen of the New York Post called it spectacular and unprecedented. George Timpson of the Christian Science Monitor called it brilliant. James Burchard of the World Telegram found more original phrasing. It was a story of psychology, pure nerve, and rowing intelligence. Mock's noodle was the best oar in the Washington boat. Royal Brougham thought long and hard about how to characterize what Bobby Mock had pulled off. Finally, he settled on, "It was positively cold-blooded." Al Ulbrichsen went down to the water and followed the boys back upriver to the shell house in his launch. As they rowed upstream in the warm summer dark, Ulbrichsen saw that they were pulling flawlessly, with the exceptional grace and precision that was quickly becoming their norm. He grabbed a megaphone and bellowed over the wet growling of the boat's engine. "Now that's it. Why didn't you row like that in the race?" The boys glanced at one another, grinning nervously. Nobody quite knew whether he was kidding or not. He was, but the comment had purpose. To reach his goal, Ulbrichsen was going to have to beat Ebright one more time. In a little less than 2 weeks, they were going to have to race again, twice, in a pair of 2,000-meter sprints, to earn the right to represent the United States in Berlin. In one of those races, California would be sitting in an adjoining lane, with one last chance to finally get even and send themselves to Germany. Ulbrichsen didn't want his boys getting all swell-headed again. And, thrilled as he was with the result, he wasn't entirely pleased with Mock's insubordination. At any rate, he needed to remind them who was in charge. But, doer, Dane or not, Ulbrichsen also felt the need to say something commensurate with the occasion. When they got to the shell house, they found hundreds of exuberant fans jockeying for space on the wobbly float and milling around in front of the building, hooting and hollering. The boys climbed out of the boat and threw Bobby Mock into the Hudson to the delight of the spectators. Then, after retrieving him from the water, they formed a phalanx, forced their way into the building, and slid the doors closed behind themselves, letting in only a few Seattle pressmen. Ulbrichsen climbed up on a bench, and the boys, clutching jerseys they'd collected from the losing crews, sat on the floor around him. "You made history today, you freshmen, junior varsity, and varsity oarsmen and coxswains. I am proud of you. Every son and daughter of Washington is proud of you. Never in history has a crew given a more gallant game fight to win the most coveted rowing honor at stake in this country than the varsity did today. And I can only say to you that I am proud and very happy." He paused and looked around the room and then concluded, "I never expect to see a better road race." Then he stepped down. Nobody cheered. Nobody stood up and applauded. Everyone just sat, silently soaking in the moment. On the stormy night in January 1935, when Ulbrichsen had first started talking openly about going to the Olympics, everyone had stood and cheered. But then it seemed like a dream. Now they were on the verge of actually making it happen. Cheering somehow seemed dangerous. Chapter 15. Therein lies the secret of successful crews. Their swing, that fourth dimension of rowing, which can only be appreciated by an oarsman who has rowed in a swinging crew, where the run is uncanny and the work of propelling the shell a delight. George Yeoman Pocock. For four straight years now, coarse outlanders from the far west have dominated the Hudson. Joe Williams of the New York World Telegram spat out the day following the Poughkeepsie races. The regatta has lost all its original form and pattern. It is no longer an Eastern show. When one Western team doesn't win, the other does. Washington took everything there was to be taken on the river yesterday. The townspeople were relieved that the visitors had the decency to leave the bridges and the fat-bodied ferries. Williams then went on, presumably in jest, to call upon President Roosevelt to do something about the very disturbing situation. The tone may have been tongue-in-cheek, but the substance of Williams' piece was no joke for thousands of Eastern crew fans. Their schools seemed to be falling out of contention in a regatta they had designed to test and demonstrate their own rowing prowess. And it wasn't just Eastern sports scribes and fans who found themselves facing a new reality after the 1936 regatta. Kai Ebright knew exactly what he had seen in the varsity race, and he was smart enough and diplomatic enough to acknowledge it straight out. Packing up his own boys for their trip to Princeton and the Olympic trials, where he would take one more stab at defeating Washington, he pointed to Joe and his crewmates and said, "There's the best crew in America. That's the boat that should go to Berlin. And the rest of the world will have to produce something pretty hot to beat them in the Olympics." This wasn't the usual pre-race downplay-your-chances banter that both he and Al Ulbrichsen regularly engaged in. Ebright was dead serious, and he needed to tamp down expectations in Berkeley. He'd go to Princeton and compete and try to win the Olympic berth, but when Bobby Mock engineered that cold, calculating, come-out-of-nowhere victory, Ebright quickly saw the demoralizing effect it had on his own crew. The deliberate way Washington rode that race had seemed partly a challenge, partly a dare, but mostly it had seemed a warning. As he made his way down the course, Mock might as well have raised over his stern a flag emblazoned with the words, "Don't tread on me," and the figure of a coiled rattlesnake. On July 1st, after a week of working out and relaxing in Poughkeepsie, the boys packed up their possessions, loaded the Husky Clipper onto the baggage car, and headed for the 1936 U.S. Olympic trials. By 6 that evening, they had arrived at Princeton and entered the world of the Ivy League, a world of status and tradition, of refined tastes and unstated assumptions about social class, a world inhabited by the sons of bankers and lawyers and senators. For boys who were the sons of working-class parents, this was uncertain but intriguing terrain. They moved into the stately Princeton Inn, perched majestically on the edge of the Springdale Golf Club's manicured fairways, a building that made even the president's home at Hyde Park look a bit cramped and shabby. From their rooms, the boys watched Princeton alumni stroll around the golf course wearing their knickerbockers, high argyle socks, and tweed caps. The boys explored Lake Carnegie and stopped by the Princeton Boathouse to check the facilities. It was a large stone structure, complete with Gothic arches over the entrances to the boat bays, a structure far more elegant than the clabbered homes most of them had come from. It was a far cry from their old airplane hangar. It looked more like the new Suzzallo Library back in Seattle. Even Lake Carnegie itself was an emblem of wealth and privilege. Until early in the 20th century, Princeton crews had rowed in the Delaware and Raritan Canal, which ran directly along the south side of the campus. The Princeton boys, though, found it inconvenient to row among the coal barges and recreational vessels that also made use of the canal, so they got Andrew Carnegie to build them a private lake. For roughly $100,000, about $2.5 million in today's dollars, Carnegie quietly bought up all the properties along a 3-mile stretch of the Millstone River, dammed it, and produced a first-class rowing course. Shallow, straight, protected, lovely to look at, and quite free of coal barges. For the first few days at Princeton, the boys kicked back and luxuriated in the posh surroundings of the hotel and country club. Don Hume tried to throw off the effects of a nasty cold. Twice a day, they took light workouts in the shell. Mostly, they practiced rowing high-stroke-rate sprints and racing starts. Starts were among the most critical components of a 2,000-meter race, and something they were having trouble with lately. 6 crews were competing for the right to go to Berlin. Washington, California, Penn, Navy, Princeton, and the New York Athletic Club. The field would be divided into 2 groups of 3 for a preliminary elimination heat on July 4th. The top 2 boats in each heat would advance to a final contest of 4 boats the next day. As the elimination heats approached, the weather grew oppressively warm, the first intimations of what was about to become a lethal heat wave all across the East. By the night of July 3rd, the boys had grown nervous and unsettled, the magnitude of what was at stake starting to sink in. They had trouble sleeping in the damp heat. Al Olbrichson went from room to room, telling them to settle down, but there was an edge to his voice that betrayed his own anxiety. That night, long after lights out, Joe and Roger sat up in the dark, joking, telling stories, trying to talk themselves down from an emotional cliff. Now and then, the darkness was punctuated by an orange glow as Chuck Day took another drag on a forbidden cigarette. It wasn't that they were seriously concerned about their preliminary heat. They would race against Princeton and the winged footers of the New York Athletic Club. Neither was a real contender. California, on the other hand, would have to face Penn and Navy, both excellent sprinting crews. The worry came from what would happen after the preliminaries. Penn had swapped out 3 of its 8 Poughkeepsie oarsmen, replacing them with recent graduates not eligible to race in the intercollegiate regatta, but perfectly legal in Olympic trials. Navy had inserted Lieutenant Vic Krulak of the Marine Corps as its coxswain. California had also moved recent alumni into its boat. Washington, in fact, was the only crew that would be made up entirely of undergraduates. Assuming the boys qualified in their own preliminary, whichever crews they met in the final would, to some extent, be made up of unknowns. Unknowns who were presumably superior to the boys they had just defeated in Poughkeepsie. On Saturday, the 4th of July, the boys left the Princeton Shell House for their race a little before 6:30. It was a buggy, sultry evening. Several thousand people had gathered along the shores of the lake for the qualifying heats, most of them climbing into the newly constructed grandstands at the finish line. The boys backed the Husky Clipper into their starting stall on a floating platform that had been specially built for the Olympic trials, and waited. At the gun, Washington charged out of the stall at a high beat of 38. The Husky Clipper began to move out in front almost immediately. After about a minute, Mock told Don Hume to drop the rate. Hume went down to 34. In the 3rd minute, Hume dropped it to 32, and even as the boys dropped the rate, the boat stayed out in front and began to widen its lead. The New York Athletic Club's winged footers and the Princeton boys were both rowing at 35. By the halfway mark, Washington had open water on both boats. As they began to approach the finish line, the winged footers made a move, sprinting past Princeton and challenging Washington. Mock told Hume to ease the stroke rate back up to 38. The Husky Clipper pulled briskly ahead and sliced across the line 2.5 lengths ahead of the winged footers. Confident as they had been, the Washington boys were nevertheless surprised at just how easily they had won. Even in the muggy evening air, they'd hardly broken a sweat. They paddled out of the racing lanes and took up a position along the bank at about the 1,500-meter mark. The real question of the day was how California would do in their qualifying heat. and the boys wanted to see the answer for themselves. At 7 p.m., Navy, Penn, and California left the mark, all rowing hard and high. For the first 1,000 meters, the three boats settled in and contended more or less evenly for the lead. At that point, Penn picked up its pace and began to move slowly out in front. As they entered the final 500 meters, though, it was Cal that brought the fans in the grandstands to their feet. The boys from Berkeley executed a tremendous surge, suddenly blowing past both Navy and Penn, seizing the lead and winning by a quarter of a boat length. It was an impressive show, and it reinforced the long-standing belief, shared by many of the coaches and riders present that day, that despite Washington's wins in the long races at Poughkeepsie and in Seattle, California remained the superior sprinting crew. It was hard to argue otherwise. California had won its heat in 6 minutes, 7.8 seconds. Washington had taken 10 full seconds longer, 6 minutes, 17.8 seconds, to cover the same distance. An almost insurmountable handicap for the Huskies, declared the New York Sun's Malcolm Roy. As the Washington boys retreated to the Princeton Inn that night, anxiety cascaded down on them again. Al Ulbrichtsen once more spent much of the evening going from room to room, sitting on the ends of bunks, reassuring his boys, reminding them that they had, in effect, won a sprint in the last 2,000 meters at Poughkeepsie, telling them what they already knew in their hearts but needed to hear one more time, that they could beat any crew in America at any distance, including California. All they had to do, he told them, was to continue to believe in one another. They nodded and agreed with him. The spring campaign, the instant fellowship they had all felt when they took to the water together for the first time, their commanding victory over Cal on Lake Washington, their stunning come-from-behind triumph at Poughkeepsie, and their almost effortless qualifying race earlier that day, had more than convinced them that together they were capable of greatness. None of them doubted anyone else in the boat, but believing in one another was not really at issue anymore. What was more difficult was being sure about oneself. The caustic chemicals of fear continued to surge in their brains and in their guts. Late that night, after Ulbrichtsen had finally retired to his quarters, the boys stole out of the hotel singly or in pairs and walked along the shore of Lake Carnegie. The moon was full, the lake silver and glimmering. Crickets sang in the grass at their feet. Cicadas buzzed in the trees overhead. They gazed into the moon-washed stars above, talking quietly, reminding themselves of who they were and what they had done. For some of them, that was enough. Joe remembered years later that a sense of calm had come over him that evening. Resolve had begun to flow into him, at first like a freshet, then like a river. Eventually, in the wee hours, they returned to their rooms and slept, some peacefully, some fitfully. In the morning, Chuck Day got up and wrote in his journal, "Final Olympic trials, very nervous but confident." Johnny White wrote, "We woke up all scared and having frequent visits with Alvin." Alvin Ulbrichtsen couldn't have been exactly relaxed himself. This was his day of judgment. Many of his peers would be on hand to watch the race that evening. Not just Ebright, but old Jim Tenite from Syracuse, Ed Leader from Yale, Jim Ray from Cornell, and Constance Titus, an Olympic champion sculler from 1904. More than that, though, Royal Brougham was there, getting set to broadcast the race live to 50 stations around the country on the CBS network. All of Seattle and much of the rest of the country would be listening. There would be no place to hide if the boys didn't come through for him. Thunderstorms rumbled over New Jersey that morning, and rain pounded the roof of the Princeton Inn. By noon, though, the clouds had scudded off to the horizon, and the day had grown hot and muggy, but clear. Lake Carnegie lay mirror smooth, reflecting a translucent blue sky. The final Olympic trial was not scheduled to begin until 5 p.m., so the boys spent most of the day lounging in the Princeton shell house, trying to stay cool. Late in the afternoon, black sedans and coupes full of crew fans began to arrive at Lake Carnegie. Their drivers eased their vehicles under shade trees along the last few 100 meters of the race course, then spread picnic blankets on the grass and opened hampers full of sandwiches and cold drinks. The grandstands at the finish line slowly filled with people fanning themselves with their programs, men in fedoras and Panama hats, women in flat-brimmed hats perched on their heads at jaunty angles. All told, perhaps 10,000 people braved the heat to witness just 6 minutes of racing, 6 minutes that would shatter the dreams of all but 9 of the